The Street of the First Shell, recorded for LibriVox by Maria Celano. 3. It was 4 in the morning when he came out of the prison of the condemned with the secretary of the American legation. A knot of people had gathered around the American minister's carriage, which stood in front of the prison, the horses stamping and pawing in the icy street, the coachman huddled on the box, wrapped in furs. Southwark helped the secretary into the carriage and shook hands with Trent, thanking him for coming. "How the scoundrel did stare," he said. "Your evidence was worse than a kick, but it saved his skin for the moment, at least, and prevented complications." The secretary sighed. "We have done our part. Now let them prove him a spy and we wash our hands of him. Jump in, Captain. Come along, Trent." "I have a word to say to Captain Southwark. I won't detain him," said Trent hastily. And dropping his voice, "Southwark, help me now. You know the story from the blackguard. You know the child is at his rooms. Get it and take it to my own apartment. And if he is shot, I will provide a home for it." "I understand," said the captain gravely. "Will you do this at once?" "At once," he replied. Their hands met in a warm clasp, and then Captain Southwark climbed into the carriage, motioning Trent to follow, but he shook his head, saying, "Goodbye," and the carriage rolled away. He watched the carriage to the end of the street, then started toward his own quarter, but after a step or two hesitated, stopped, and finally turned away in the opposite direction. Something, perhaps it was the sight of the prisoner he had so recently confronted, nauseated him. He felt the need of solitude and quiet to collect his thoughts. The events of the evening had shaken him terribly, but he would walk it off, forget, bury everything, and then go back to Sylvia. He started on swiftly, and for a time the bitter thoughts seemed to fade, but when he paused at last, breathless under the Arc de Triomphe, the bitterness and the wretchedness of the whole thing, yes, of his whole misspent life, came back with a bang. Then the face of the prisoner, stamped with a horrible grimace of fear, grew in the shadows before his eyes. Sick at heart, he wandered up and down under the great arc, striving to occupy his mind, peering up at the sculptured cornices to read the names of the heroes in battles which he knew were engraved there. But all was the ashen face of Hartman followed him, grinning with terror. Or was it terror? Was it not triumph? At the thought, he leaped like a man who feels a knife at his throat. But after a savage tramp around the square, came back again and sat down to battle with his misery. The air was cold, but his cheeks were burning with angry shame. Shame? Why? Was it because he had married a girl whom chance had made a mother? Did he love her? Was this miserable bohemian existence, then, his end and aim in life? He turned his eyes upon the secrets of his heart and read an evil story, the story of the past, and he covered his face for shame, while keeping time to the dull pain throbbing in his head, his heart beat out the story for the future. Shame and disgrace. Roused at last from a lethargy which had begun to numb the bitterness of his thoughts, he raised his head and looked about. A sudden fog had settled in the streets. The arches of the arc were choked with it. He would go home. A great horror of being alone seized him. But he was not alone. The fog was peopled with phantoms. All around him in the mist they moved, drifting through the arches in lengthening lines, and vanished, while from the fog others rose up, swept past and were engulfed. He was not alone, for even at his side they crowded, touched him, swarmed before him, beside him, behind him, pressed him back, seized and bore him with them through the mist. Down a dim avenue, through lanes and alleys white with fog, they moved, and if they spoke, their voices were dull as the vapor which shrouded them. At last, in front, a bank of masonry and earth cut by a massive iron-barred gate towered up in the fog. Slowly and more slowly they glided, shoulder to shoulder and thigh to thigh. Then all movement ceased. A sudden breeze stirred the fog. It wavered and eddied. Objects became more distinct. A pallor crept above the horizon, touching the edges of the watery clouds, and drew dull sparks from a thousand bayonets. Bayonets! They were everywhere, cleaving the fog or flowing beneath it in rivers of steel. High on the wall of masonry and earth a great gun loomed, and around it figures moved in silhouettes. Below, a broad torrent of bayonets swept through the iron-barred gateway, out into the shadowy plain. It became lighter. Faces became more distinct among the marching masses, and he recognized one.
"You, Philippe!"
The figure turned its head. Trent cried,
"Is there room for me?"
But the other only waved his arm in a vague adieu and was gone with the rest. Presently the cavalry began to pass, squadron on squadron, crowding out into the darkness, then many cannon, then an ambulance, then again the endless lines of bayonets. Beside him a cuirassier sat on his steaming horse, and in front, among a group of mounted officers, he saw a general, with the astrakhan collar of his dolman turned up about his bloodless face. Some women were weeping near him, and one was struggling to force a loaf of black bread into a soldier's haversack. The soldier tried to aid her, but the sack was fastened, and his rifle bothered him, so Trent held it while the woman unbuttoned the sack and forced in the bread, now all wet with her tears. The rifle was not heavy. Trent found it wonderfully manageable. Was the bayonet sharp? He tried it. Then a sudden longing, a fierce, imperative desire took possession of him.
"Chouette!" cried a gamin clinging to the barred gate. "Encore toi, mon vieux?"
Trent looked up, and the rat killer laughed in his face. But when the soldier had taken the rifle again, and thanking him, ran hard to catch his battalion, he plunged into the throng about the gateway.
"Are you going?"
he cried to a marine who sat in the gutter bandaging his foot.
"Yes."
Then a girl, a mere child, caught him by the hand and led him into the cafe which faced the gate. The room was crowded with soldiers, some, white and silent, sitting on the floor, others groaning on the leather-covered settees. The air was sour and suffocating.
"Choose,"
said the girl with a little gesture of pity.
"They can't go."
In a heap of clothing on the floor he found a capote and kepi. She helped him buckle his knapsack, cartridge box, and belt, and showed him how to load the chassepot rifle, holding it on her knees. When he thanked her, she started to her feet.
"You are a foreigner."
"American,"
he said, moving toward the door. But the child barred his way.
"I am a Breton. My father is up there with the cannon of the marine. He will shoot you if you are a spy."
They faced each other for a moment. Then, sighing, he bent over and kissed the child.
"Pray for France, little one," he murmured.
And she repeated with a pale smile,
"For France, and you, bon monsieur."
He ran across the street and through the gateway. Once outside, he edged into line and shouldered his way along the road. A corporal passed, looked at him, repassed, and finally called an officer.
"You belong to the 68th.
Growled the corporal, looking at the number on his kepi.
"We have no use for frontières,"
added the officer, catching sight of his black trousers.
"I wish to volunteer in place of a comrade," said Trent,
and the officer shrugged his shoulders and passed on. Nobody paid much attention to him, one or two merely glancing at his trousers. The road was deep with slush and mud, plowed and torn by wheels and hoofs. A soldier in front of him wrenched his foot in an icy rut, and it dragged himself to the edge of the embankment, groaning. The plain on either side of them was gray with melting snow. Here and there, behind dismantled hedgerows, stood wagons bearing white flags with red crosses. Sometimes the driver was a priest in rusty hat and gown, sometimes a crippled mobile. Once they passed a wagon driven by a sister of charity. Silent, empty houses with great rents in their walls, and every window blank, huddled along the road. Further on, within the zone of danger, nothing of human habitation remained except here and there a pile of frozen bricks or a blackened cellar choked with snow. For some time Trent had been annoyed by the man behind him, who kept treading on his heels. Convinced at last that it was intentional, he turned to remonstrate and found himself face to face with a fellow student from the Beaux Arts. Trent stared.
"I thought you were in the hospital."
The other shook his head, pointing to his bandaged jaw.
"I see you can't speak. Can I do anything?"
The wounded man rummaged in his haversack and produced a crust of black bread.
"He can't eat it. His jaw is smashed, and he wants you to chew it for him," said the soldier next to him.
Trent took the crust, and grinding it in his teeth morsel by morsel, passed it back to the starving man. From time to time, mounted orderlies sped to the front, covering them with slush. It was a chilly, silent march through sodden meadows wreathed in fog. Along the railroad embankment across the ditch, another column moved parallel to their own. Trent watched it, a somber mass, now distinct, now vague, now blotted out in a puff of fog. Once for half an hour he lost it, but when again it came into view, he noticed a thin line detach itself from the flank and, bellying in the middle, swing rapidly to the west. At the same moment, a prolonged crackling broke out in the fog in front. Other lines began to slough off from the column, swinging east and west, and the crackling became continuous. A battery passed at full gallop, and he drew back with his comrades to give it way. It went into action a little to the right of his battalion, and as the shot from the first rifled piece boomed through the mist, the cannon from the fortifications opened with a mighty roar. An officer galloped by, shouting something which Trent did not catch, but he saw the ranks in front suddenly part company with his own and disappear in the twilight. More officers rode up and stood beside him, peering into the fog. Away in front, the crackling had become a prolonged crash. It was dreary waiting. Trent chewed some bread for the man behind, who tried to swallow it, and after a while shook his head, motioning Trent to eat the rest himself. A corporal offered him a little brandy, and he drank it, but when he turned around to return the flask, the corporal was lying on the ground. Alarmed, he looked at the soldier next to him, who shrugged his shoulders and opened his mouth to speak, but something struck him, and he rolled over and over into the ditch below. At that moment the horse of one of the officers gave a bound and backed into the battalion, lashing out with his heels. One man was ridden down, another was kicked in the chest and hurled through the ranks. The officer sank his spurs into the horse and forced him to the front again, where he stood trembling. The cannonade seemed to draw nearer. A staff officer, riding slowly up and down the battalion, suddenly collapsed in his saddle and clung to his horse's mane. One of his boots dangled, crimsoned and dripping, from the stirrup. Then out of the mist in front men came running. The roads, the fields, the ditches were full of them, and many of them fell. For an instant he imagined he saw horsemen riding about like ghosts in the vapors beyond, and a man behind him cursed horribly, declaring he too had seen them, and that they were Uhlans. But the battalion stood inactive, and the mist fell again over the meadows. The colonel sat heavily upon his horse, his bullet-shaped head buried in the astrakhan collar of his dolman, his fat legs sticking straight out in the stirrups. The buglers clustered about him with bugles poised, and behind him a staff officer in a pale blue jacket smoked a cigarette and chatted with a captain of hussars. From the road in front came the sound of furious galloping, and an orderly reined up beside the colonel, who motioned him to the rear without turning his head. Then on the left a confused murmur arose, which ended in a shout. A hussar passed like the wind, followed by another and another, and then squadron after squadron whirled by them into the sheeted mists. At that instant the colonel reared in his saddle. The bugles clanged, and the whole battalion scrambled down the embankment, over the ditch, and started across the soggy meadow. Almost at once Trent lost his cap. Something snatched it from his head. He thought it was a tree branch. A good many of his comrades rolled over in the slush and ice, and he imagined that they had slipped. One pitched right across his path, and he stopped to help him up. But the man screamed when he touched him, and an officer shouted, "Forward! Forward!" So he ran on again. It was a long jog through the mist, and he was often obliged to shift his rifle. When at last they lay panting behind the railroad embankment, he looked about him. He had felt the need of action, of a desperate physical struggle, of killing and crushing. He had been seized with a desire to fling himself among masses and tear right and left. He longed to fire, to use the thin, sharp bayonet of his chassepot. He had not expected this. He wished to become exhausted, to struggle and cut until incapable of lifting his arm. Then he had intended to go home. He heard a man say that half the battalion had gone down in the charge, and he saw another examining a corpse under the embankment. The body, still warm, was clothed in a strange uniform, but even when he noticed the spiked helmet lying a few inches further away, he did not realize what had happened. The colonel sat on his horse a few feet to the left, his eyes sparkling under the crimson kepi. Trent heard him reply to an officer, "I can hold it, but another charge and I won't have enough men left to sound a bugle." "Were the Prussians here?" Trent asked of a soldier who sat wiping the blood trickling from his hair.
"Yes, the hussars cleaned them out. We caught their crossfire."
"We are supporting a battery on the embankment," said another.
Then the battalion crawled over the embankment and moved along the lines of twisted rails. Trent rolled up his trousers and tucked them into his woolen socks, but they halted again, and some of the men sat down on the dismantled railroad track. Trent looked for his wounded comrade from the Beaux-Arts. He was standing in his place, very pale. The cannonade had become terrific. For a moment the mist lifted. He caught a glimpse of the 1st Battalion motionless on the railroad track in front, of regiments on either flank, and then, as the fog settled again, the drums beat and the music of the bugles began away on the extreme left. A restless movement passed among the troops. The colonel threw up his arm. The drums rolled, and the battalion moved off through the fog. They were near the front now, for the battalion was firing as it advanced. Ambulances galloped along the base of the embankment to the rear, and the hussars passed and repassed like phantoms. They were in the front at last, for all about them was movement and turmoil, while from the fog, close at hand, came cries and groans and crashing volleys. Shells fell everywhere, bursting along the embankment, splashing them with frozen slush. Trent was frightened. He began to dread the unknown which lay there, crackling and flaming in obscurity. The shock of the cannon sickened him. He could even see the fog light up with a dull orange as the thunder shook the earth. It was near, he felt certain, for the colonel shouted, "Forward!" And the 1st Battalion was hastening into it. He felt its breath. He trembled, but hurried on. A fearful discharge in front terrified him. Somewhere in the fog, men were cheering, and the colonel's horse, streaming with blood, plunged about in the smoke. Another blast and shock right in his face almost stunned him, and he faltered. All the men to the right were down. His head swam. The fog and smoke stupefied him. He put out his hand for a support and caught something. It was the wheel of a gun carriage, and a man sprang from behind it, aiming a blow at his head with the rammer, but stumbled back shrieking with a bayonet through his neck, and Trent knew that he had killed. Mechanically, he stooped to pick up his rifle, but the bayonet was still in the man who lay beating with red hands against the sod. It sickened him, and he leaned on the cannon. Men were firing all around him now, and the air was foul with smoke and sweat. Somebody seized him from behind and another in front, but others in turn seized them and struck them solid blows. The click, click, click of the bayonets infuriated him, and he grasped the rammer and struck out blindly until it was shivered to pieces. A man threw his arm around his neck and bore him to the ground, but he throttled him and raised himself on his knees. He saw a comrade seize the cannon and fall across it with his skull crushed in. He saw the colonel tumble clean out of his saddle into the mud. Then consciousness fled. When he came to himself, he was lying on the embankment among the twisted rails. On every side huddled men who cried out and cursed and fled away into the fog, and he staggered to his feet and followed them. Once he stopped to help a comrade with a bandaged jaw, who could not speak but clung to his arm for a time and then fell dead in the freezing mire. And again he aided another, who groaned,
"Trent! C'est moi, Philippe,"
until a sudden volley in the midst relieved him of his charge. An icy wind swept down from the heights, cutting the fog into shreds. For an instant, with an evil leer, the sun peered through the naked woods of Vincennes, sank like a blood clot in the battery smoke, lower, lower, into the blood-soaked plain. End of part 3 of The Street of the First Shell from The King in Yellow.